Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to go ahead. It's 2 o'clock, and we're going to go ahead and get started. I'd like to welcome you all to the School for Successful Ranching. My name is Bert Barnes, and I'll be moderating the session today. At this time, I'd like to ask you to place all your cell phones on silent, please, and if you could remove your hats. We would like to take this time also to thank our generous sponsors for the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on the floor here. We ask that maybe you go visit their booths and on the expo floor as well. If you just tell them a little thank you as well. We wouldn't be able to do this without them. Our sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corteva, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Raybo Agri Finance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Once again, please silence your phones, remove your hats, and our next presentation is on is more cow pregnancies, fewer calf losses, faster genetic improvement, presented by Dr. Brad Lindsay with Ovitra Biotechnology. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lindsay.
How about now? Is that better? Okay. thank you all for the opportunity, Tech Southwest Cattle Raisers, for having me here. This is my first time to present at this meeting. Was any of y'all in the session this morning Donald Brown gave on the keeping your family in the ranch and your ranch in the family? I, too, am a product of Throckmorton County. My dad was the county extension agent there for 12 years, between 62 and 74, and I'm a product of his raising, because I knew the Browns growing up, and Donald's older siblings, Rob A. and Betsy, were Betsy's a year older than me, and Rob A.'s a year younger than me, so we went to school together, went through life together, and, you know, Throckmorton County is a ranching country, and it's a harsh country. Robert E. Lee spent some time out there during the Civil War and writes in his journal that at the time he didn't think it was a good place for him to be. He thought it was beneath him. But he writes later, when they were retreated after getting sorely whipped in a battle, that it made him the leader that he became. And I'd like to think that's what happened to me. I spent a lot of time following my dad around in his footsteps, looking at everything from bloated cows, helping him pull calves, because we didn't have a veterinarian in the county at the time, looking at aphids on pecan trees, looking at rust on wheat, just you name it. And it helped me get a sense of the bigger picture of agriculture, and helped me eventually find a place I wanted to be, which started out, actually, incidentally, with a focus on horses. But I ended up returning to my roots, I guess you could say, after, I guess, in all fairness to horse owners, getting tired of dealing with horse owners that had no cow sense, if you understand what I mean. But I love cattle. Donald was talking about finding your passion, and this is my passion. I wake up every morning and figure out what's the next challenge that I'm facing. pardon me if my voice is a little scratchy. I was hoarse last week, and I'm still kind of on the mend. But in trying to take cows is great. But this is what we're after, right? A nice set of calves on the ground beside those cows. And so that, you know, when you start looking at cattle reproduction, what can we do to improve reproduction, then we got to focus here. And how do we get back to picking the right cows, managing cows the right way to produce lots of these big, healthy babies? And this is my perspective, okay? You find me almost any day of the week, ask Joe Dowling sitting right there, that's my position. And my right shoulder will tell you a lot of stories because it's starting to wear out a little bit. But I pretty much grew up in the wake and the advent of ultrasound. And so a lot of my experiences are based on, you know, not hands-on, but hands-in, okay? And that ultrasound become my eyes. You know, I can see exactly what's going on in that reproductive tract, and I've learned so much and continue to use it every day that I'm out there. But one thing that standing in this perspective gives me was a unique perspective. Most people look at cattle, you know, from a profile, from the side. And I started learning some things that I'll share with you later that I see from standing behind a cow. There's some unique things there. But the other part of this talk is that you're going to get the benefit of 36 years of my experience of deadly focus on reproduction. I mean, reproduction in cattle is what trips my trigger. I love, you know, trying to figure out what makes these beasts tick and how to do better. There's a lot of room for improvement in reproduction. So about 14 years ago, I formed this business, Ovitra Biotechnology, and I guess in a way is paying homage to my dad and his county extension agent methods of helping other people through his constituency. I'm just doing it in a private manner. I do a lot of consulting, training, as well as commercial embryo transfer work, and that goes hand in hand with commercial producers. I do a lot of work with commercial producers. In fact, truth be told, I might prefer to work with commercial producers as opposed to purebred operators because there's a little more attention sometimes to those things that actually make difference. I mean, if you're a commercial producer, let's face it, you're going to focus on bottom line. You're going to focus on, you know, things, and it's not necessarily about the show ring. It's not about EPDs. But we're going to get into some of those things that may help you. And so that's who we are. So I apologize for this slide because it didn't really start out the way I want it to, but it doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about building a pyramid, so don't try to take it that way. But what I want to focus on is the overview of this talk is, you know, we're going to look at some basic management things that are at the top of the list in terms of importance, and it has a lot to do, obviously, with some of those things we may take for granted now. The reproduction is affected by all of these things, but nutrition and herd health. And, you know, you may have heard lots of talks and understand these things perfectly. And yet there's some things that we need to point out as they pertain to reproduction and how to get our cattle bred at the right time and with enough efficiencies. And then we're going to talk about some pre-breeding management tools and some schemes that we can use to screen cattle as well as select cattle proactively to fit into our herd. You know, we want to wean the dead wood, you know, so to speak, out of the herd. But we also want to propagate the ones that are, you know, going above and beyond. And then lastly, I want to talk about a few things that are near and dear to my heart, the embryo transfer, and how you as a commercial producer may be able to integrate some of those things. And you may not even realize. Okay, so just as a matter of survey, I want to ask you all some questions. Just raise your hand if you use or own any of these things or technologies, techniques. Do you have a set of scales, weigh scales, okay? Do you have a hydraulic squeeze chute or chutes, okay? Do you have do you use computer spreadsheets or database management software of any kind, okay? How about reproductive ultrasound? And lastly, how about embryo transfer technology in any form? Okay, that's partly for me to understand my audience, so thank y'all for that. I'm going to jump a little over here to facilities real quick. Again, sometimes this is a given, but you know, anytime we're layering on what I call stacking technologies. We're starting out basically with turning cows out with bulls, and there's not a lot to that except somebody's got to figure out, you know, buy the bull, figure out the best mating for those pastures, how many bulls, so on. But beyond that, anything you do, if you want to synchronize and do AI, if you want to, you know, go on up the ladder and do some embryo work from a recipient standpoint and then a donor standpoint, and maybe even go to IVF or, God forbid, you know, cloning or transgenic embryo production, those are some real things. But at every level, you're going to have to stack in more layers of management and possibly facilities. You know, you need good working pens. You need good, you know, ability to sort cattle out of in and out of paddocks. You need, you know, hay rings and troughs and all these kind of things that, you know, I'm preaching to the choir about. You may have need good, you know, squeeze tubs and alleyways to flow cattle through, hydraulics. When we get down to the first point that I want to make about the links between reproduction and some of these other things, the facility part will come back into play and I get to the end, but I want to start back over here with the relationship between nutrition and cyclicity. When I started in this industry 36 years ago, we still didn't understand a lot about those relationships between nutrition and reproduction, and we do now. We understand a lot. And, you know, the relationship between that feed bag and that cow being able to put a good calf on the ground consistently every year is an important one. This graph right here shows a really, really neat relationship that it's old data now, is produced in 1986, for crying out loud. But if you look at this, this is the number of days postpartum on the left, how many days it takes a cow to start cycling after she calves, based on her body condition score. And if we use a 1 to 9 body condition score system, you would know that a 3 is an emaciated cow. Okay, she's not cycling at that moment. She is skinny. You can see most of her frame. A 4, you're still going to probably be able to see a good part of her ribs, but she's fleshing up. And you get on up to a 7, which is one stage away from obese. An 8 has got some pones of fat and is obese cow. But look at how many days it takes that emaciated cow. It takes her 3 months, assuming that she's, you know, taking the nutrition that she was providing that calf in that last trimester. Now it's going over to lactation and hopefully a little left over for her to get going cycling again. And as you go up in body condition, look at there. 1 month. I have cattle in the spring coming up here, and, you know, calving now, that they'll be cycling in 30 days naturally. So that's an important relationship to keep in mind. As you can see, the effect of body condition score on calving, at calving. These body condition scores, if I didn't say it, are at calving, okay? And so when you carry that forward to pregnancy rate, then these cows that are, you know, they may look like they're in okay shape, got a little rib showing, it's still going to, you know, hit their pregnancy rate pretty hard. So, you know, the take-home message here is, you know, you probably need to be somewhere between a 5 and a 6 at calving. So what that means is back up to that third trimester and consider what's that cow's nutrition at that time. And it's not too late to supplement those cows in that third trimester. And yes, I know there's a lot of talk out there. I don't believe most of it, that you feed them in that third trimester where you're going to grow those calves too big and cause dystocia. No. You may, if they go, you know, depending on, it may be a mismatch in terms of an embryo to a particular type of recipient. But most of the time, if you feed them to maintain this kind of body condition, you're not going to end up inducing dystocia by overfeeding that third trimester. That calf is literally starting to suck the life out of that cow because it's in the most high demand of protein. The calf is. All right, so I want to talk a minute about environmental versus epigenetic effects. And that may be a new word for y'all. I'll break it down. I want to give you an example, a most recent, real recent example of an environmental effect that we have to be concerned with. This last fall and winter, and I don't know where y'all are from, what parts of the state, but in the Brazos Valley, I'm currently in Madisonville, Texas, in the Brazos Valley, between the Trinity, the Brazos, and the Navasota Rivers. And we have been inundated with rain. Annual rainfall there is supposed to be 40. I think we had over 60. And I know Donald said that Throckmorton, you know, its annual rainfall is like 24. And I think they got over 40. So when we have these kind of excess rainfall years, what that's doing is it's leaching a lot of that nutrient. It's percolating right through the soil. It's not coming up in the grass that those cattle are trying to eat. And so as a result, let's see. This thing is doing this thing. Let's see if that do it. There we go. Little dialogue. So what we saw, this is what we experienced with the breeding season this fall. When we started trying to breed fall calving cows in December, they were taking longer, just like that slide I showed you with the cows that had lower body condition. It took them longer to start cycling. Well, because of that decrease in the nutrition in the soil, the plants didn't have it, so they weren't getting it if they weren't being compensated, you know, with the supplement. And so we saw cows that just, it was taking them a lot longer to start cycling. We had lower response rate to synchronization protocols, and so far we're seeing the same come up with a little lower pregnancy rate. I mean, we had as much as 20% lower response rates to our synchronization protocol, whereas normally we might have 70 or 80% of all the cattle that we synchronize show heat. We were down to, you know, 50 or 60. And anytime, and this is one of these correlations, I can't quite put my finger completely on the mechanism, but anytime I have, you know, more than a 30% non-response rate, I know that the 70% that do respond are probably going to have a lower pregnancy rate than if they had a high, you follow what I'm saying? So there's this correlation there as well. The response rate to your synchronization protocol is a great indicator of how well your breed up is going. If you got 85, 90% of them showing good heats when you breed them, you're probably going to do all right. The other thing, and this is related to nutrition, is if y'all heard the talk from Cliff's group of researchers from A&M, we're talking about heifers achieving puberty, and the effect of nutrition has affected them as well during critical times post-weaning, so that it has taken them to longer, you know, our virgin heifers longer to achieve puberty. So these are all an example. This is an example, I guess, what I'm saying, of an environmental effect. And we just kind of have to be cognizant and aware of, you know, what's the year? What is it? It's not going to be like last year. One of the rules of thumb that I learned early on was kind of what I call the heat stress rule of summer. And you can pretty much mark this down. Anytime we see the temperature elevate to 95 degrees every day and it doesn't go back, then the clock's ticking. We have about 30, 45 days before we start seeing things affect the eggs that were produced by those cows that were cycling that, you know, 30 days prior. And we see this with donor cows. The number of grade ones goes down. The number of grade twos and threes go up about 30 to 45 days after that heat period starts. And so we shut it off. And then inversely, when it finally cools off in early September, maybe mid-September, if we give them another 45 days before we start doing something else with them to try to breed or synchronize, then we'll be better off. And this goes back to the heat stress on the ovary. The ovaries are not like the testes and the bull. They're outside the body and can cool off. The rumen is the largest organ in the body of the cow, and so it impinges and presses against specifically the left ovary and decreases its activity. But when that core temperature of that cow goes up, it also decreases her overall ability to produce viable eggs and therefore pregnancies. So environmental effects, we got to watch. Okay, here's the most recent example I can tell you about what we call an epigenetic effect. An epigenetic effect is one that is an environmental influence on the genome, the DNA. And I can illustrate this best by giving you this example. In 2012, we had a pretty bad drought, and there was the talk about epigenetic effects. You know, how does or does the environment influence, you know, the DNA in any way? And the hypothesis was that, yes, when cattle that are gestating heifers, calves, heifer pregnancies, during a restricted nutrition, then that may affect, probably will, does affect that heifer's fertility. The question was, is it permanent? Well, guess what? It is. So if you've got cattle that are being gestate, you know, that are gestating heifer pregnancies during a drought, feed them. They are not going to eke it out without affecting these the heifers that they're carrying. Those heifers will have what we call a reduced antral follicle count. If we go in those heifers at puberty, it's a good time to get a measure of their potential as a breeding female. We can count how many follicles. It's kind of like doing scrotal circumference in bulls. You know, you do scrotal circumference in bulls, that bull's going to produce more sperm than one with smaller. When we look at antral follicle counts in heifers at puberty, it's sort of, this effect kind of goes away after they mature, but at puberty is a close correlate to her ability to produce eggs as a donor, as a cow. And so we saw this, these antral follicle counts in these heifers that were gestated during drought period without supplementation had lower follicle counts. And again, that's permanent. We also saw lower weaning and mature weights in those heifers. Okay, and now that genome has been suppressed in a way that they will pass that on to their daughters. There's no undoing it. And, of course, lower inherent fertility from the standpoint of conception rates. So you may have probably, how many of y'all heard of epigenetic effects before today? Okay, a few of you. So it's something to be mindful of. As we learn more about the genome, then there will be more things like that emerge that we don't know yet. So one of the questions that, you know, comes up in my world all the time is, are your cows cycling? Well, my advisor was a stickler for grammar, and he would say, well, Brad, are they riding tricycles or bicycles or what kind of? He made us talk about reproductive cycles. So when I say, are they cycling, you know what I mean. But what about their reproductive cycles? How do we know? And are there times when cattle aren't cycling? Well, of course there are. We call it anestrus, not in estrus, not cycling. of course, prepubertal heifers. They're not cycling yet. We have cows, once they calve, they go into this postpartum anestrus. They're not cycling yet. And then we have nutritional anestrus, that cows are not cycling because they don't have enough nutrition. What do you think is the number one reason? There's another one I haven't listed yet. The number one reason for cows not cycling. Anybody? Pregnancy. Yeah, we overlooked that, right? Why aren't they cycling? And I get a group almost every week, and they're like, why isn't this cow cycling? Well, she's 6 months bred. Oh, my gosh, she's never been with a bull. Really? Tell that to the neighbor. One of y'all's lying. But seriously, we need to know not just if these cows are cycling or not, but why. And so I'm going to run through this as quickly as I can about anestrus cattle. Let's start back with prepubertal. What is the definition of puberty? Is it when you see that heifer out there getting mounted and being ridden? No. It's when they have their first ovulation. And the only way you're going to determine that is somebody to palpate that heifer or ultrasound her. I had a guy bring me a heifer one time, and he wanted to start collecting embryos from this heifer in the worst way. And I said, I will not do it until she starts cycling on her own. He said, well, she's in heat last week. I'll bring her. Ultrasounded her, big fat follicle, did not ovulate. I said, take her home and let's reboot. He brought her back to me four times. She had four cycles, quote unquote cycles, every 20-ish days without ovulating. Why is that? Well, nothing's wrong. It's just she's not mature yet. There's one connection that's last to come online, and it's, believe it or not, it's a brain maturation thing. And what it is the hypothalamus talks to the pituitary and tells the pituitary to release a hormone called LH. And LH is a hormone that induces ovulation. And so once that brain loop is completed from the hypothalamus to the pituitary to the ovary, now the heifer's mature and she'll do it. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but it was talked about, one of the questions that came up in this last session that was in here was, what about giving a heifer a protocol with a cedar versus a single shot of prostaglandin? And the answer was, that the cedar can induce heifers to start cycling. It's like priming a cold engine. You know, you kickstart a motorcycle a few times and it may sputter out. But if you prime it, warm it up, it may. And so that's kind of what a cedar does. A cedar is a natural hormone. It's the same hormone that the CL produces. But I'm going to hold the part two of that answer, because there is one reason why you might not want to use that protocol in preference to a single-shot prostaglandin. The timing or the onset of puberty in heifers is controlled by many factors. Okay, many factors. Age, weight, the breed, the genetics, nutrition, of course, the season of the year, and epigenetics. All these things complete a big picture to that individual heifer as to when she will start cycling. And so this was part of the research that the group, I did my PhD in the mid-90s at University of Nebraska, and one of the research focus was precocious puberty. Precocious puberty is that you probably heard stories or had some of your own where you got a 7-month heifer when you come in and, you're at time to synchronize and breed, and you've got a 14-month heifer, and she's already like 5 months bred. Well, how does that happen? Precocious puberty. Early maturity, and she is either with another bull or a calf. There's precocious puberty in bulls, too. So if you don't separate your bulls and your heifers after weaning, it can happen. But we were studying precocious puberty to try to see if we could induce it. Can we induce puberty to come on faster? And we really didn't find a good way other than just maintaining their natural path of their genetics with proper nutrition to get them to that point as fast as they naturally would. But one thing that we did find, if you develop heifers to approximately 65% of their mature weight before breeding, then they're going to be on target. And it's probably preferred to do that in pastures as opposed to feedlot, pens, just because they're going to have better mobility when they get out there in the breeding pasture and not fall apart. But the other thing we found, and this was the one thing that will bring the onset of puberty on a little faster if you must, and that's some form of fence line exposure to bulls because of the pheromones. They're the aerosolized hormones. When they start cycling and the bulls emit, and they emit hormones, and they also detect hormones. And so there's this reciprocal communication through these hormones that are born in the air. And virgin heifers can, they don't always, but they can start cycling as much as 6 weeks earlier if they have had some form of fence line exposure to bulls. All right, so postpartum anestrus in cows. This is something that's unavoidable in cattle. We have to managed through it. The length of that postpartum anestrus period is influenced by one factor is dystocia. If the cow has any form of calving problems, it's going to slow her down. If the cow has, you know, a poor body condition before calving, at calving, or, you know, after calving, there's three periods there that her nutrition may need to be adjusted. But if at some point it is lower than it needs to be, then it's going to take her longer to start cycling on her own. And, of course, season, the time of the year, mares have this unique ability that they shut down in the winter. They stop cycling, and it's all linked to the optic nerve talking to the pineal gland, which basically says, okay, it's winter. We have a 340-day gestation. We have no business getting pregnant right now, so we're just going to shut it off. And then when the day length starts getting longer in the spring, they start cycling. We can arbitrarily induce that to change by putting mares under lights. I don't know if you knew that, but you can put mares under an extended photo period, and they'll start shedding off and cycling in January if you're doing that in November. But cattle, although they're polyseasonal, meaning they cycle year-round, they're still subject to this same effect hormonally. So the day length communicates to the brain through the optic nerve, and it says, you know what, it's spring and things are looking pretty good, the grass is good, we can turn it on. And that's why, you know, cows calving in the fall versus the spring are going to be less reproductively efficient. They're not going to respond as high to synchronization drugs as a percentage of response. They're going to take longer postpartum, all these things. When we give cattle a shot of luteolase or estromate, the average is 60 hours from injection to heat, to her showing that first mount. In later in the spring, that could shorten up to as little as 36 hours, maybe 48. In the fall, winter, it may take 72 hours for that shot to bring that cow into heat. All right. So when we're trying to induce cattle, and this is kind of goes back to what I was talking about with heifers and inducing them to cyclicity with protocols like cedar. And like I said, the cedar is a great product because it is the native hormone. Progesterone is the same hormone that the CL produces. And part of its role is to precondition the uterus for a conceptus. If you break down the word progesterone, it's the Latin for pro, gestation, gestrum. And so one of the things that we can do is, again, to precondition that cow for pregnancy is to use a cedar synchronization protocol. And another tool is to layer on with that calf restriction. And so what we do is you remove those calves, restrict those calves from those cows at the time you remove that cedar, and it triggers another hormonal response that tells that cow, well, maybe we don't have a calf to feed anymore. We've got enough energy going here. Let's go ahead and cycle and come in heat. And it kind of tightens up your synchrony a little bit. And so it can help induce higher percentages of ovulation and cyclicity. So calf restriction is one of those double-edged swords because it takes a lot more time management to sort those calves, and then you're going to listen to them bawl all night long. And I know y'all know what I'm talking about. But it can be an effective tool if you're having trouble getting cattle to come on like they need to. Where am I? A little deal popped up. So the results of that, you may not see any result, and it may not be of any benefit, but it actually may also increase the activity and the cyclicity and ovulation of those cows enough that you can increase the pregnancy rate as much as 15% in an AI herd. Okay, nutritionally anestrous cows, common sense now, you should know. This, again, is mainly managed through body condition score and by the appropriate feeding. And what I mean by appropriate feeding is you must know what are the inputs that that cow's getting from your pasture and your hay and your mineral or whatever she's out there getting free choice before you go and to say, okay, we're going to start feeding this particular total mixed ration or how much. You really need to spend some time doing a feed a hay analysis, a forage analysis, maybe, you know, test your soil and figure out, you know, if there's some fertilization that needs to be done. But, you know, you need to complement what she's getting out of the pasture. So when we're selecting cows for breeding, my rule of thumb is at least 40 days postpartum in general before we initiate a synchronization protocol. By the time we get to the, and this is largely coming from an embryo transfer perspective, you know, it takes us 17 days from putting a seeder in until we're putting an embryo in. And so by that time, she's right at 60 days if she's at least 40, 45 days postpartum. It's going to give her adequate time for uterine involution and healing. You want them to be at a body condition score of 5 or higher, no problems of dystocia. Otherwise, I mean, if you just, you know, carte blanche, synchronize everything in herd, you're probably going to be wasting some drugs, costing some money. So cows that don't meet those criteria, they're going to take longer they're going to have lower percentage of responses, poor quality oocytes or eggs, and therefore lower pregnancy rates. That's all. I mean, if you've got the money to burn and throw at all of them, that's fine. But sometimes we go through and even screen cattle by ultrasound if we suspect there's a reason to, before we start putting a lot of drugs in them. And I can tell you, I get a lot of calls now from people who have tried it once, and they want me to come and preg check on the day of seeder because they know I'm probably going to find some things out for them that they didn't realize. There's that one, you know, cow that got bred by the neighbor bull, and it's better to find it out then at 6 months than whenever I come back to put an embryo in. And, she aborted a five-month calf last week when she was supposed to be in heat. So those kind of things can be really good time savers, and it's nothing for me when I'm doing an ultrasound. It's like, okay, she's open. You want to put a seeder? Yep, boom, we're done. So it kills two birds with one stone. Okay, so this is something I tried to find a slide on some data that would support this, and I couldn't find it. It exists, I promise you, but there's, you know, we need to, again, optimize these feeding regimes on our breeding herds. And when we know that we need to increase the body condition score on a group of cows, here's some little factoids that I've listed out. We need to start that feeding regime. If we realize and recognize we do need to boost their energy a little bit, and I say energy because all too often I find people are overfeeding protein. Right, Joe's smiling. Protein costs a lot of money, and it takes a lot of energy to break it down into a metabolizable form of energy. Think grain. Think corn chips, okay? That's what's going to make the cattle fat. That's what's going to make them cycle. But it's not going to have much of an effect if you start feeding it the day you put seeders in. You really need to back it up to about 60 days prior to have, because it takes a while for the body's metabolism to catch up and say, oh, we've been being fed pretty good for the last 2 months. Whoa, let's get pregnant. A balanced ration that complements the pasture and hay. They need to be fed and monitored for intake. Make sure they're eating what you're putting out in front of them. And monitor their gain. If you've got those true test scales, they shake the dust off of them and weigh your cows. And a single point weight doesn't do any good, does it? You got to weigh them twice to be able to see, is she gaining, she losing, or is she maintaining? And if you know that, then you should have at least, if you want to get into what the old timers call the flush effect, not talking about embryos, talking about the spring flush, then they got to gain at least a quarter of a pound a day. It doesn't take much gain. But that cow, metabolically speaking, will understand, hey, We got a quarter pound a day and tomorrow and the next day, and that puts them in this positive plane, and they start cycling. But it takes time. And feed them through the first trimester. If you have to feed them up to breeding, this is the point. I couldn't find the slide. I could not find a slide to support what I'm about to tell you, but I'm telling you, it's out there. There was a really elegant experiment that was done just a few years ago where they fed cattle kind of a maintenance diet. They were in flesh enough that they could cycle. Let's say, I don't remember, but let's say they were body condition score fives, okay? They were fed a maintenance diet to keep that body condition. And then there was another group that was fed a high diet. They were given a little higher energy. Then they were bred. At breeding, they did what's called a double switchback. So they took half of each group, and they put some half of the highs on the low diet or the maintenance diet, and the other half of the low diet, maintenance diet, on a high diet. When they looked at pregnancy rates, all three of the four groups were the same at about 70%. One group dropped 20%, 50%. Which group? Bingo, from high to low. So if you're of the mindset, yeah, we're going to feed them, we'll feed the snot out of them until we get them bred, and then we're going to turn them out. A lot of people do it, I know. It's probably the worst thing you could do, because you're probably going to lose. Those cows are going to go backwards, and they're going to say, wait a minute. We was on this great diet, and now he's cut it off. We don't have no business getting pregnant. I mean, that's a simplistic way of saying, you know, metabolically, the cow can recognize what you're doing to her. You can cheat, but don't cheat on the first trimester. If you have to cheat, the second trimester is a better place to do it. So I wish I had that slide. I just couldn't find it. Okay, here's a little slide to throw in. Selecting and culling. Who stays and who goes? And I drew up this imaginary conversation between these cows that says, hey, you think we're going to get AI this time? That, you know, get selected for that. That's a pretty good deal. Another cow says, well, I don't know, but we're not going to get selected if we don't eat up. The other cow says, well, gosh, all I thought we had to do was just stand still in the chute. No, there's a little more to it than that, isn't there? And that's what I want to talk about. I mentioned earlier EPDs. And I know, you know, some of y'all think, and that may be a good thing for you, may be a bad thing. The Holstein, the Angus, Brangus, a lot of breeds are starting to integrate the use of EPDs, expected progeny differences. They're numeric values placed on genetic merit that's based on offspring and data that is hard. And it takes a lot of numbers to generate these. And I'm not trying to say that you should go out there with a commercial herd and start blood testing them and getting EPDs on them. But what I'm going to tell you is some correlations that you know. You already know this stuff I'm about to tell you about. This is one they call Cavanese Direct. What is Cavanese Direct? Well, that's the effect of a particular sire on his calves. And that's one to pay attention to. If you would know, I mean, you should know or find out, you know, the bulls you're putting over your cows, what is, you know, are they going to give you big calves or not? And inversely, Cavanese maternal, that's the effect of a particular dam line on producing larger versus smaller calves. So scrotal circumference, oddly enough, and like I said, there is this correlation. This is the male version. The female version is the ovarian size and activity. And it directly, I shouldn't say directly, it indirectly correlates. If we look at bulls with high scrotal, when we look at sisters, they typically have larger antral follicle counts in their sisters than bulls with smaller scrotal. And when we do embryo transfer on donors, we see that. We see those correlations exist. Heifer pregnancy. This is one, I don't know if the heritability correlation is very high yet, but it's emerging. It seems to be relatively accurate, but it's relative to virgin heifers and their probability of getting bred at puberty. So there's some genetic factors that play into a heifer's ability to get bred. And I've seen this when we screen heifers. You look at them and it's like, you know, that's a big old heifer. She ought to be cycling, and she's not. And the one next to her is, you know, 150, 200 pounds lighter, and she's already cycling. There's genetics involved in that. Stability. This is something that I noticed years ago, and it wasn't even a thing yet, but it was in donor cows I was collecting. And remember I was telling you about my perspective? I'm standing behind these cows, and I started noticing these cows that were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and they're still pumping out 12 embryos per flush. And I started noticing some things in terms of phenotype, and it had to do with the angles from their hooks and pins to their shoulders. You know, they weren't straight, and they certainly weren't wider in the shoulders than they were the hips, but they had a nice, you know, slight angle. And also from their hooks and pins over to their withers, you know, they weren't elevated, they weren't level, they were just... They weren't down in the front, but they had just a, you know, small degree of slope. And I don't know if that's related to this or not, but I know this. I know cows that have bad angles have dystocia problems. They have more problems with urine pooling, which leads to uterine infections. They have more problems with prolapsing and things like that. But stability, and like I said, I called it longevity of fertility, and it basically means is that what is the probability of that cow still being in the herd as a six-year-old? You know, a cow that's paying her way every year and she's not getting culled has got some merit. All right, docility. One of the other talks this morning was about this temperament, and it's heritable. So, you know, y'all probably don't like chasing or being chased by crazy cows any more than I do. And she passes that on to her offspring, both genetically and from an environmental influence, meaning the calf is going to mimic what the cow does. Now, this is an interesting one. I find this one really fascinating. This one's called cow energy value, or dollars energy. And what this is relative to the lactation energy requirements for a cow and her mature cow size. So if you think about it, a great big old cow that isn't very energy efficient is going to chew up a lot of feed and may or may not produce a calf. But think about those, and down in the Madisonville area, we got people a little further east and northeast of us that raise cattle, and some of y'all may be in this group, but everybody know what a piney wood rooter is? You know, a cow that'll eke out a living on pine needles and still raise a calf. I have a Hereford producer that has a 700, maybe 750-pound cow that raises a 600-pound calf every year. Not much energy requirement for that cow. Very efficient. So those are important EPD factors that we know about in the commercial world that we can incorporate. I'm going to skip those two. But here's an example, I guess, of that energy issue. This group of cows on top, you look at them, these are those body condition score fours I was talking about, maybe four and a half. You can see some rib, and they kind of drawn looking, they looking a little haggard, right? And look at this group of cows, nice and slick, fat. Well, what's wrong with this picture? There's one thing wrong with each group. These cows are standing around a feed trough waiting on the next meal ticket, right? These are all a bunch of open cows. They're like one or two or maybe three-time losers on embryos and getting resynced, and they look great. They're great to look at from one standpoint, but they're chewing up feed. They're not doing their business. These cows just got weaned. So, yeah, they're suckled down. They had raised nice 6-7 month calves, and guess what? They're already bred back. So these cows, and their udders are full. So I'd much rather, you know, deal with a bunch of those than these. So these are the energy-efficient cows. These are probably not, and that's the point. Back to my passion, ultrasound. Like I said, I've learned most of what I've learned by looking inside a cow through the ultrasound. And I'm going to have to rush through this because I'm watching my time here. Reproductive tract scores, they talked about a little bit in that morning session. I take this five-point scale and I bring it down to three. I just consolidate the ones and twos and the fours and fives. And if we evaluate heifers prior to breeding, this slide right here will show, this is some data that reproductive tract scores were taken prior to breeding or natural service. And if you look right here, the ones and twos and threes, this is the percent of pregnancy rate on AI in this column. And it's below 50%. So we wasted a lot of time and money synchronizing heifers that weren't ready at all. They need another 45 to 60 days. The reproductive tract is a one, is infantile. Two, it's just a little bigger. A three, there may be some follicular activity, and they're thinking about it. Number fours, they got a lot of follicular activity, maybe a pre-ovulatory size follicle or two. And the fives already have a CL, so they're already cycling. Well, when you look at these data here, here's some twos, threes, and fours. Look how many days. If you find, you know, in this scale of fours and fives, and my scale would be the threes, median number of days to pregnancy, 10 days. Essentially, synchronize them, breed them, bred. So reproductive tract scores can be one really useful tool to screen heifers before you sink a lot of drug into them. And back to the point I made about the single-shot prostaglandin, if you want to determine which cattle, which heifers are the ones that are maturing early on their own, then do a single shot. If you're using a seeder, you might be arbitrarily inducing those heifers to cycle a little earlier than they would, and you're covering up or masking that genetic aspect where, you know, you're going to see those. And if you just use a single shot every year, and what I like to do, a single shot, breed everything on natural heat, 14 days later, a second shot to the non-responders, and breed them on heat. And over time, you'll weed out all your late maturing heifers, or a lot of them. All right, so I'm probably going to have to skip this part, but suffice it to say that we do some blood work, screening cattle, especially as recipients. If we're going to be putting $600-$700 embryos in recipients, we might lead them and look at things like this. This is a Texas Veterinary Medical Diagnostic Lab's abortion screen, looking at Brucella, which, you know, everything's supposed to be vaccinated for that, and that usually comes out negative anyway. But Neospora is a protozoa, can't be vaccinated for. You get about a third of your positives aborting in the third trimester. So my red flag advice for you is if you've got cattle you preg check and you know they were bred at preg check and then you come up at calving and they're open, you better bleed that cow. She's probably neo-positive. Eventually, if you don't weed those out of your herd, I promise you, it's in your herds. It's carried by dogs, coyotes, rats, coons, and it's a slow, silent killer. It'll creep in the herd and build. Another one is Lepto. Even in herds where we're vaccinating once or maybe twice a year, you'll always pick up these moderate to low titers, and I don't get too concerned about them. We may rebleed that cow to see if she's still, you know, dealing with something. You've got to do this far enough away from your vaccine so you're not picking up vaccination titers. But something like this, where all five strains are positive and it got a couple that are pretty hot, I'm not going to breed that cow. That cow's going to either get cold or she will get another blood test later and see if she cleans up. I'll take questions privately after this if y'all want to talk about that some more. I got to move on. Let's see. So stress, Yeah, I'm going to skip. So, pregnancy determination. Again, I live behind an ultrasound. We can use ultrasound as early as 4 weeks. So 28 days, consistently pick up a heartbeat. It's accurate. It's instant. The results are very fast. So we can sort right there on the spot instead of waiting for results of a blood test. It's non-invasive. It's safe. I've got guys that, you know, claim palpate at 35 days, and if they're too rough, they will slip, induce abortion, early abortion. You can more rapidly identify different issues that come up, like uterine infection, cystic, ovarian disease, twins. I pick up twins once in a while, just not looking for them, but just look, oh, there's twins. So, and you get them out to 65 days. We can do a gender identification somewhere between 60 and 100 days. It's very accurate. And, you know, when we're doing AI versus bull bred or embryo versus bull bred AI, you know, it's real easy. You get these cows synchronized, and then looking at basically 20-day intervals, I always, you know, quiz the producer, okay, when do the bulls turned out, when do they pulled, so I know the range I'm looking for, and, you know, what was the AI dates, maybe I don't know. Maybe they're all bull exposed, but the ultrasound is very accurate to determine, you know, within the first trimester, within days of conception. In the second trimester, and probably, you know, plus minus 2 weeks. In the third trimester, probably, you know, you can be as much as plus minus a month. But thou shalt not. These are some summary statements about, you know, making a plan, sticking to it. When we're doing a breeding, you know, select your synchronization protocols based on what works best for a particular group of cows. You know, there is no magic bullet. There is no magic synchronization protocol. But you need to match that protocol for that group of cows or heifers. And feasibility. What does it cost? Can I manage it? You know, we can adjust protocols and reduce a step, combine a step. But, you know, it's not just something to do willy-nilly. Consult with someone who, like me, has had a background and training in reproductive endocrinology, or at least understands the mechanisms behind each shot or step. Use a reliable method or person to do your pregnancy determination and make those hard calls. I know it's hard sometimes. We get sentimentally attached to some cows, but, you know, I watched the guy one time. In fact, he's a former director of this association, Leonard Singletary. And he was hard on them. He would cull them with one bad quarter, and that was it. Smooth mouth, 30 days bred when, you know, she should have been 60. Disposition, it's like a one-strike-you're-out mentality. And they went on the bus that day. And I respected that because he always had a high breed-up. You know, we'd get high 90s breed-up and calve most of them out. And resist that temptation to hold that cow over one more year, you know. That'll put you upside down just like you get upside down in a vehicle if it depreciates faster than you're getting return on it. And, you know, keep an eye on those exceptional performers because you can use them to propagate and rebuild a herd. And you can do that. And yes, even you, as a producer, a commercial producer, can use embryo transfer, like I just told you. You've seen these spreadsheets and scenarios where you can justify going into and doing an AI program because of the increased pounds of meat that you're weaning off versus caring for a bunch of bulls and the cost to maintain those bulls. Well, you can develop the same sort of spreadsheet. And I don't have it because it's very complex because every situation is different. But you can develop a spreadsheet that would show you the cost benefits to doing an embryo transfer round or two or whatever to build some replacement heifers, to build some herd sires, as opposed to going out and buying them every year. I won't bore you with the protocol, but you know there may be some additional facility requirements to do an ET. I have a mobile lab. I've gotten into designing and building setups for people as part of my consulting business. The economics, I'm not going to go through that. And here's those things I've been alluding to. You've got in-herd or within-herd genetics that you can take advantage of, coupled with sex semen. The sex semen deal now is real. I mean, they've raised the quality enough that we're flushing cows with sex semen and getting excellent results. We might be one or two embryos lower on the averages than without sex semen, but guess what? They're 95%+ of the gender that we want. So we're raising more heifers if that's what we want, and no bulls. Okay. All right, well, just y'all talk to me afterwards if you need to. You can buy outside genetics. You know, you can go partners with somebody on a donor. You can introduce new genetics to your herd through embryo transfer. You can set yourself up as a cooperator herd. And, again, visit with me about that if that's something. There's a way to make money as a forward contractor for purebred operators, putting their embryos in your cows. And it's very lucrative. I have to leave that. Do your homework. Make a plan. Stick to it. Be productive and proactive. Y'all know this stuff. Common sense. That's my team. Thank you.